Headlines: Ukraine's military says it's evacuating all remaining troops from the last stronghold in Mariupol, ceding control of the city to Russia. EU foreign ministers failed to reach an agreement on a proposed oil embargo against Russia over the war in Ukraine. And a study shows more than half of Britons have seen their health deteriorate as a result of the cost of living crisis. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Ukraine's military says it is working to evacuate all remaining troops from the southern port city of Mariupol, ceding full control to Russia after weeks of a siege. The military has also announced an end to the combat mission in the city. On Monday, hundreds of Ukrainian forces, many of them wounded, were transferred to Russian-held towns. Moscow earlier said that a deal had been reached to evacuate the injured troops. Some 600 soldiers and civilians were holed up in Mariupol's Azovstal steel plant for over 2 months as Russian forces took control of other parts of the city. Ukraine's deputy defense minister says that all of the evacuees will be subject to a potential prisoner exchange with Moscow. Meanwhile, Russia continues its airstrikes on Kyiv and Lviv near Poland's border. A series of blasts have hit Lviv a few hours ago, but so far no reports of casualties or damage. While the conflict in Ukraine continues, correspondent Johnny Miller has traveled to the Petrovsky district near the front line in Donetsk to investigate reports on the shelling of Donbas civilians by the Ukrainian army.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school. Two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbas separatists. The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done. A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home. I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them. Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many like Yulia prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery. While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says that NATO's eastward expansion and the West's disregard for Russia's security concerns are to blame for the war in Ukraine. Saeed Khatibzadeh said NATO must realize that the confrontation does not have a happy ending. He also criticized the failure of the West to abide by the agreements it struck with Russia. Moscow launched a war in Ukraine on February 24th, citing Kyiv's failure to implement the terms of the Minsk agreements first signed in 2014. Russia also pointed to security threats posed by NATO's eastward expansion and demanded guarantees that Kyiv would never join the U.S.-led military alliance, or bloc. NATO, however, rejected the request. Sweden and Finland are the latest in their bid to join NATO, despite warnings from Moscow. Well, Russia expels two staff members of the Finnish embassy in Moscow in response to a similar move by Helsinki in April. The Russian Foreign Ministry says it summoned Finland's ambassador and handed a note declaring the two diplomats persona non grata and ordered them to leave the country. The ministry also said it expressed strong protests at the expulsion of the two Russian diplomats from Finland as part of the EU's anti-Russia campaign. It also slammed Helsinki for supplying weapons to Ukraine and taking a, quote, confrontational stand towards Russia. The ministry accused Finland of covering up the crimes of Ukrainian nationalists against civilians. Western countries have expelled hundreds of Russian diplomats since the outbreak of the war in Ukraine in February. Retaliation, Moscow has also expelled scores of Western diplomats. EU foreign ministers have failed to reach an agreement on the sixth round of sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine. The latest tranche includes a proposal to ban imports of Russian oil to the EU, but Hungary is blocking the move over economic concerns. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Ukraine for weapons to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these 2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes, the Council of the EU, Brussels.
The surge in the cost of living in the UK is taking a heavy toll on the health of Britons. According to a YouGov poll, 55% of Britons say that their health has worsened due to such factors as heating and food costs. One in four cited assessments by medical professionals, adding that stress was a contributing factor to their ill health. According to the Royal College of Physicians, this should sound the alarm, especially as the inflation crisis has barely begun. Retailers have been warning that food price inflation could hit 10% in Britain this year. That is partially driven by the war in Ukraine and the overall consumer price inflation that hit 7% in March. The Bank of England says rising food prices are a major concern. A U.S. Congresswoman is putting forth a resolution to the House of Representatives for the recognition of the well-documented Palestinian Nakba. Rashida Tlaib, who is of Palestinian descent, tweeted that the Nakba continues to happen today. Just days ago, Palestinians marked the 74th anniversary of the Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe. The occasion marks the forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes by Israel in 1948. Since then, millions of Palestinians have been living in a refugee camp in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in neighboring countries. Tlaib says when people refuse to acknowledge the Israeli war crimes, Palestinians are denied their humanity. Several Palestinians' rights groups have praised the move against Israel, which has enjoyed widespread support from Washington for decades. Christian churches in the occupied West Bank condemn an Israeli attack on the funeral of slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. In a statement, representatives of 12 Christian denominations called the attack on Abu Akleh's funeral on Friday a, quote, violation of the freedom of religion. They noted that the actions of Israeli forces constituted an invasion and disproportionate use of force. Separately, the Catholic Archbishop in Al-Quds slammed the regime forces for storming into a Christian health institute, disrespecting the deceased, and forcing the pallbearers to almost drop the coffin. Shireen Abu Akleh, who was working for the Al Jazeera TV network, was fatally shot while covering an Israeli army raid in the city of Jenin last week. Anger over her killing was compounded on Friday when Israeli forces beat mourners carrying her casket from a hospital to a church for the funeral service. Official results from Lebanon's parliamentary elections show independent candidates have made unprecedented gains in Sunday's polls. According to the Interior Ministry, independent candidates won at least 13 seats in the 128-member assembly. They campaigned against Lebanon's ruling elite and vowed to bring about reforms. The resistance movement Hezbollah and its allies won 62 seats but lost their majority. Hezbollah opponents, including the Saudi-aligned Lebanese forces, a Christian faction, gained ground. The results leave parliament split into several camps, with none of them having an absolute majority. This raises the prospect of political paralysis and tensions that could delay reforms needed to steer the country out of its devastating economic crisis. A heavy dust storm has forced the closure of schools, universities, and public offices across several Iranian provinces, including the capital, Tehran. The dust storm, originating from Iraq and Syria, entered Iran on Monday, blanketing eight provinces, mostly in the west. The concentration of fine dust particles in some cities is 20 times higher than safety levels. In neighboring Iraq, officials say that at least 4,000 people have swarmed hospitals with breathing problems. This is the eighth sandstorm to hit Iraq over the past month. A thick cloud of dust has enveloped the capital, Baghdad, in an orange glow, prompting the city's authorities to declare a day off for local government institutions. Baghdad International Airport has halted all flights and closed its airspace until further notice. According to the UN, Iraq is the fifth most vulnerable country to climate crisis. Yemen's national airline operates its first commercial flight in years from the capital, Sana'a. The flight arrived in Sana'a from Jordan. Abdul Latif al-Washadi was on the scene and brought us this report.
The first commercial flight has landed at Sana'a International Airport almost 7 years after the Saudi-led coalition forced the facility to shut down its ordinary air travel. The opening takes place 6 weeks behind the schedule after a UN-brokered ceasefire was enforced in early April. This is due to repeated delays by the Saudi-led coalition under different pretexts.
Today, the first civilian plane has arrived at Sana'a Airport after a closure that lasted for more than 6 years, and there is a flight that will go to Amman Airport in Jordan carrying 130 passengers. The turnout is large, and people are eager to travel through Sana'a Airport amid the exceptional circumstances and a large number of patients. We call on the United Nations and all international organizations to demand that the Saudi-led coalition stop its siege and open the airport without any restrictions.
Officials say thousands of patients are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Keeping the airport closed has pushed many Yemeni patients desperate to seek medical treatment abroad to the brink amid the critical health conditions.
We were not able to travel through another airport because of the difficulty of traveling by road and the rugged roads. As my health situation was critical and I couldn't take the long way to another city.
There was a deliberate delay by the Saudi-led coalition to operate flights through Sana'a's airport, especially since 41 days have passed since the implementation of the UN brokered truce. We hope that Yemeni civilians will profit from the opening of the airport, that the truce will be extended, and that the airport will continue to be operational, as it's a civilian airport that does not serve any military authority.
Under the two-month truce that was brokered by the United Nations at the beginning of April, there should be two flights from Egypt and Jordan and back there every week. However, the truce will end in 2 weeks and the terms of the armistice have not yet been implemented.
People here hope that the UN brokered truce will be extended and that Sana'a International Airport will always be open to humanitarian flights, as it is a humanitarian necessity to save the lives of thousands of patients, including children, who are waiting for the chance to travel abroad for treatment. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In an attempt to increase U.S. military engagement in Africa, Washington is set to redeploy troops to Somalia. President Joe Biden has approved the reposition of fewer than 500 ground forces to the East African country. Washington is seeking to justify the decision by claiming that intelligence suggests the terrorist group Al-Shabaab could soon pose a threat to the region's security. Biden's decision will reverse the withdrawal of 750 U.S. troops from Somalia in 2021 that was ordered by his predecessor, Donald Trump. The Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab has been fighting against the Somalian government for more than a decade now, targeting both civilians and military personnel in bloody attacks. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. Well, you must be following news related to the nuclear matter. As I have said before, and as other government officials have said before, including Mr. President, who has repeatedly stressed this matter, you must not at all wait for the nuclear negotiations when doing your planning. You must not wait for it in any way. Do your work. Look at the current condition of the country and do your planning accordingly. The negotiations might reach a certain point, positive, half positive, or negative. Whatever happens, you must do your own work and you must not make your affairs contingent upon the negotiations. Fortunately, the Honorable Minister of Foreign Affairs and the negotiating team delivered their detailed reports to the President and the Supreme National Security Council. They are being updated on the matters and therefore they will make a decision. They think and consider the various aspects of the matter. Of course, it is all right to criticize these officials and express one's viewpoint. But first of all, you should take care not to express viewpoints in a pessimistic manner. I have always said to officials in all administrations that our attitude towards the people in the middle of the arena should not be pessimistic and cynical attitude. Well, there are pious, revolutionary, diligent, and hardworking people in the arena, and they are working in this regard. If one wishes to make a criticism, it has to be an optimistic, not pessimistic one. Secondly, it must not undermine the people who are busy working in this arena. The people's hope should not be undermined either. In other words, we should not speak in a way that the people lose their hope.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Of course, our negotiating team has thankfully resisted the other side's bullying, and by God's favor, and without any doubt, they will continue to resist. He who has broken his promise is the other side. They themselves have faced serious problems because of having violated their promises. In the present time, the other side, which broke its promises and which tore the deal to pieces, as they themselves put it, is stuck in a dead end. We do not thankfully feel stuck in a dead end. We have managed to endure the hardships and pass through them. We have passed through many problems so far, and we will pass through other problems from now on too, God willing.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On May 15, 1948, the Zionist regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed Zionist forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the 1967 war, also known as the Six-Day War. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with East al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. The Gaza Strip has also been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea siege since 2007, and witnessed three wars since 2008. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the Zionist regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, thousands of Palestinians and their supporters across the globe have taken to the streets to hold mass rallies in commemoration of the 74th anniversary of Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, and to condemn the recent killing of a veteran Palestinian journalist by Israeli forces. Shirin Abu Aghla was fatally shot by Israeli troops as she was covering an army raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Targeting the media organizations and journalists isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
This is something that is extremely important because it is the part of the historical memory of culture and people who have been subjugated by an illegal occupation of an apartheid regime.
In an expression of solidarity with the people of Palestine, the Iranian Foreign Ministry stated that addressing the issue of Palestine should be the first and foremost issue for the Muslim world, saying any attempt by global Zionism to drive the issue into oblivion would be doomed to failure. The Iranian ministry also stated that the anniversary of Nakba puts on display the failure of international institutions and organizations to resolve one of the longest-running humanitarian and political crises in the world. Israel has managed to get away with its crimes for decades as it enjoys Washington's unwavering support. The U.S. provides the regime with billions of dollars in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions.
Well, I think that the complicity of basically the Western political class in its entirety and the media in the West is inseparable from the question of Israeli impunity. Israel knows full well that it can do whatever it wants, that it can kill journalists, that it can kill Palestinian children, that it can continue with administrative detention and systematic torture of Palestinian prisoners, and that they'll get away with it because they will never be sanctioned by any of the so-called Western democracies.
This has quietly encouraged the Tel Aviv regime to continue violating the rights of Palestinians and to displace them and to steal their land. But how long will the regime of Tel Aviv be able to extend its illegal existence through carnage and plunder? Former Israeli Premier Ehud Barak has expressed concern about Israel's survival, saying the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. The ultra-conservative former premier's comments echo prevailing fears in the occupied territories. A recent survey of young Israeli adults found that nearly half of the population in the occupied Palestinian territories is not optimistic about Israel's future, with more than one-third of people thinking about migrating for jobs and better life. Many analysts have pointed to the theory of collapse from within regarding the future of Israel, citing three factors of economic crisis, poor security situation, and social divisions for the imminent decline and fall of the regime.
On Wednesday, two journalists covering an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin for Qatari broadcaster Al Jazeera came under attack. Ali Al-Samoudi was shot in the back but survived. His colleague, Shireen Abu Akleh, however, wasn't as lucky. The reporter was shot in the head and was pronounced dead after being rushed to the hospital. The attack came despite them both wearing vests with the word press emblazoned on them.
It wants the image of absolute lawlessness and operating with impunity. What could be more criminal than the targeted assassination? And just to even to say how strongly the whole world feels and the outrage at the assassination of Shireen Abu Akleh.
Also, according to eyewitnesses, the attack was unprovoked as there was no confrontation between Palestinians and the regime's forces at the time of the assault on the journalists.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We, a group of journalists, were there wearing our full press uniform in addition to the helmets with the word press written in large letters, as big as the whole world. We were obvious. We made sure to walk right in front of the army patrols so that they can see us, and they saw us after we went to a road where there were no armed people, no civilians, and there were no shooting and no incidents there. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death.
But the regime didn't spare Abu Akleh, even at her funeral. Israeli troops attacked mourners carrying the slain journalist's casket outside the hospital, causing the coffin to almost fall to the ground. She was later laid to rest in a cemetery in occupied East Al-Quds. The journalist's killing and the subsequent attack during her funeral were met with international condemnation, with Israel's closest ally, the United States, calling it, quote, deeply concerning. The United Nations human rights experts have called the incident a serious attack on the freedom of media and expression and called for a transparent investigation. The case of the journalists set to be brought to the International Criminal Court, a tribunal that has in the past attempted to probe Israel's rights violations and war crimes against Palestinians, but failed to do so due to political pressure and sanctions from the United States. Israel's aggression against countries like Syria and Lebanon has also been protested in the international arena. But so far, the reactions from the international community have been limited to verbal support. That begs the question, will Tel Aviv face any accountability for its crimes?
Within international courts, because who controls international courts? And who controls the International Criminal Court while they're not even a signer to it? That's U.S. imperialism. So I don't think Israel will be brought to any kind of justice or accountability through this, but I think it's up to the people of the world, it's up to all honest reporters, journalists, and news services to make sure that this does not go unmarked.
Some observers also ascribe the intensified Israeli pressure on Palestinians to some Arab states' moves to normalize ties with the regime. The Arab states had claimed that their decisions would help the Palestinian cause, an excuse that has repeatedly proven to be nothing more than mere window dressing over the past 2 years. Many Palestinians believe that in the absence of any international accountability, resistance remains their only way forward.
A state of shock in America, especially among members of the Native American community, following the identification of over 500 student deaths at U.S. boarding schools. The deaths of Native American children were confirmed as part of the first stage of a federal study of boarding schools that operated for over a century. They were supposed to assimilate the indigenous children into white society between 1819 and 1969. The number of deaths could be only the tip of the iceberg, as the U.S. Interior Department warns that with further investigation, the number of known student deaths could climb to the thousands or even tens of thousands. The initial findings of the comprehensive study have turned a spotlight on the dark history of more than 400 Native American boarding schools notorious for brutal conditions. Hundreds of thousands of indigenous children were forced by the U.S. federal government to attend the institutions. The children were separated from their families by force, forbidden from speaking their languages, and often abused. A large number of them never returned home. The painful legacy of the notorious system operated by the government and churches has been felt deeply across Indian country and through generations. The high-profile federal review was ordered by U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland last year after the discovery of unmarked graves at the site of former residential schools in neighboring Canada.
So it's the same history, really. There's really, the thing is, the United States had such a huge population of Native people, such a wealth of anthropology. If you could imagine what anthropologists today would give to be able to hurriedly record all those languages and take pictures, but they're gone. You can't even record the dead civilizations. And if they were allowed to live, the earth would be so much wealthier. It's really just a terrible, terrible tragedy. That is the real genocide. That's genocide number one.
The U.S. Interior Department's report was released on Wednesday. It highlighted instances of beating, withholding of food and solitary confinement, and other forms of abuse at U.S. boarding schools. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents attended such schools, seems to be very serious about the investigation. She has ordered her agency to fully investigate what remains of the evidence of the horrific abuses.
Now we are uniquely positioned to assist in the effort to recover the dark history of these institutions that have haunted our families for too long.
She says the consequences of federal Indian boarding school policies, including the trauma caused by the family separation and cultural eradication inflicted on generations of children as young as 4 years old, are heartbreaking and undeniable. Brian Newland, the Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Indian Affairs, believes further investigation is needed to better understand the lasting effects of the boarding school system on American Indians. Newland said there is not a single American Indian, Alaskan Native, or Native Hawaiian in the country whose life has not been impacted by the notorious boarding school system. Meanwhile, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition warned that efforts to find the remains of the indigenous children must continue until the United States fully accounts for the genocide committed against Native American children. The latest findings are shedding light on the plight of Native Americans in the United States. They are still suffering from many problems, including racial discrimination. Pressure is mounting on the U.S. establishment to come to terms with and learn lessons from its dark past.
On May 10, 2021, Israel began an offensive on the Gaza Strip that went on for 11 days. The regime razed several buildings in the meantime, including a tower housing the bureaus of several news outlets, including Al Jazeera's. The bombings killed over 250 Palestinians in the besieged enclave, including dozens of women and children. But this time, unlike other incidents where Israel launched attacks on the Strip, Palestinian resistance movements struck back hard, killing at least 12 Israelis.
We have to remember that while there have been deaths on both sides, the deaths of Palestinians far outnumber those of the Israelis, probably by close to 1,000 to 1. So there is not a lot of importance given to Palestinian lives. This has been an ongoing, longstanding policy of the world. It's completely unjust. It ignores international law and human rights, but this has been the case. But any efforts to bring rights to the Palestinians, rights that they are entitled to by international law simply because they live, because they exist, will be opposed because no other country wants to risk its economic ties with Israel.
The conflict had been in the making for several weeks prior when Israeli troops intensified their crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds during the holy Muslim month of Ramadan. The protests that had erupted at the regime's attempt to evict several families from the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah also escalated tensions. The devastating conflict ended in an Egypt-brokered ceasefire that went into effect on May 21st. The battle, however, significantly altered the perceptions about the military capabilities of Israel and Gaza-based resistance groups. The 2021 confrontation is widely hailed as a victory for Hamas and other resistance movements in Gaza, not only militarily and on the ground, but also morally on an international level. Demonstrations in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza and the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood were held across the world. A wider and more diverse group of people around the globe called for an end to the conflict and Israel's aggression, which helped raise awareness about the plight of Palestinians to a much higher extent.
Israeli invisibility can mean a number of things. You're referring to militarily, but there's also the invincibility that it had for so many years as being seen as the victim, the innocent victim just trying to defend itself. That has certainly been shattered. People around the world, even if they support Israel, see Israel as the aggressor.
A year on, Tel Aviv is once again intensifying the pressure on the Palestinians. Israeli forces and settlers have repeatedly raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound over the past few weeks, a location that's considered Islam's third holiest site. In response, there has been a spike in the number of deadly Palestinian retaliatory operations across the occupied territories. Palestinians say the attacks are a natural response to Israel's desecration of Al-Aqsa, an issue they warn is their red line. The mounting tensions between Palestinians and Israelis are raising fears about another confrontation. But the events over the past couple of years have indicated that Palestinians will continue to fight for what they believe in and that they can inflict pain on the other side, too.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره، همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إن هذه القلوب تمل كما تمل الأبدان فابتغوا لها طرائف الحكمة.
أمير المؤمنين
Ali alayhi salam said, "The hearts become tired as the bodies become tired. You should therefore search for beautiful sayings for them to enjoy by way of refreshment."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, in this truly universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali, talks about the heart. Now, when he talks about the heart, he tells us the different aspects of this heart. Now, we're not necessarily talking about specifically this physical material heart, which is in our rib cage and in our chest. Now, there is a possibility that this is what is being spoken about, but in reality, what is being spoken about is this heart and this emotional center, this center of where the love of Allah presides in one's heart. Now, one of the things that we tend to do as human beings is to have hope in other people. So, for example, sometimes among the busyness of our daily lives, we believe that, you know, such and such manager has the solutions to our problem, or a certain teacher or a certain expert in a medical field, or a certain professor or a certain guide or a certain individual has the solutions to our problems. Now, interestingly, when we feel that an individual, a human being, has the answers to our problems and the solutions to our problems, well, we begin to set our hopes upon that certain individual. Well, before I say what I was going to say, first and foremost, we must set our hopes upon the mighty, the exalted Allah. All of our hopes and all of the solutions to our problems are with the Almighty Allah. That needs to be something that we establish in our heart and in our soul. And of course, other individuals who might have the solutions to our problems are, for example, the Holy Prophet, the divinely appointed Imams from the household of the Holy Prophet, and, you know, it comes down to the religious scholars, the honorable and righteous religious scholars, and of course our parents, and so forth. But our hope should always and ultimately be upon Allah. Here Imam Ali alayhi salam says something really interesting. He says, "Whoever sets their hope on others, the latter's awe and glory will be in your heart." And so, of course, as we have said in other programs as well, and as the spiritual masters of the acquirement of the love of Allah teach us, the heart should be the place where only the awe and glory of Allah should be. And therefore, our ultimate hope and our ultimate gaze, metaphorically speaking, should be upon Allah, for we only want Allah's awe and glory in our heart. And as Imam Ali says, if we set our hopes upon people or certain individuals, then it is that person's awe and glory which will be established in our heart. A beautiful, profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah, to administer His earth and to convince the mankind to accept His plan. Peace be upon you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen. I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you.
تبقي عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Prophet saying, Ya Ali, now the Quran says, Ma atakum ar-rasulu fakhudhuh. Whatever the Prophet did, you and I must do. When the Prophet says, Ya Ali, then I will also say, Ya Ali. In addition to this, some people may ask the question, fine, the Prophet of Islam mentioned Ya Ali, but did he specifically say, we, you and I must mention it? Of course he did. You'll find the famous narration in which we find it in several books by our brothers Ahl Sunnah, such as what? Such as Kanz al-Ummal by Al-Muttaqil Hindi in volume 11, such as the book by Allama Jalaluddin al-Suyuti, Al-Jami' al-Saghir, such as the book by Ibn Asakir, Tariq Dimashq, non-Shia books, they come forward and say that Rasulullah said, ذِكْرُ عَلِيٍّ عِبَادَةٍ The mentioning of Ali is worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. People ask the question, when the Prophet says, ذِكْرُ عَلِيٍّ عِبَادَةٍ The mentioning of Ali is what is worship. What does this mean? Does this mean, God forbid, it is the worship of the commander of the faithful? Of course not, because Amir al-Mu'mineen is a servant of God. In fact, the Prophet of Islam is described in the Holy Quran as what? As Abdullah. When the Quran comes forward and says, Subhanalladhi asra bi'abdihi laylan min al-masjid al-haram ila al-masjid al-aqsa alladhi barakna hawla. That's why, of course, this station of servitude